I can turn it off.
So we'll have like 10 minutes of networking and snacks, so please have your seat.
So starting in 10 minutes?
Yeah. So harder to be abused or something similar.
So what is your
Thank you. It's demanding because
Good evening, friends. My name is Ankit Agarwal, and I'm one of the executive committee members of IITians Association of Australia. So on behalf of all the EC members, I would take this opportunity to welcome you to this event, philosophical event, Dharma of Business. All of us, we experience some sort of business dealings in our day-to-day life. It may be as simple as dealing with our families, or it may be as profound as dealing with clients. However, have you ever thought of taking a more holistic or philosophical approach to apply dharma in business, in our day-to-day life? Today's event is all about that. And the speaker is a very special guest, His Holiness Bhakti Prasamrita Swami. Swamiji is a sannyasi in ISKCON tradition and is a current temple president of ISKCON Belgaum, where he is overseeing the development of a self-sufficient eco-village. He is a Bachelor of Engineering from MS University, Baroda, and he has done his MBA from Mumbai University. He has also worked in multinational banks such as DSP Merrill Lynch and Standard Chartered in management positions. However, being deeply inspired by a higher sense of purpose, he decided to dedicate his life to propagate the timeless wisdom of Indian Vedic scriptures and its practical applications. He has been a guest speaker, invited speaker, at many prestigious Indian institutions, including our very own IITs, and at many corporates, including Ernst & Young and Commonwealth Bank of Australia. So without taking much of the time, I would now like to invite Swamiji for the talk. And yep, thank you.
ओमध्यानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूप कदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरुः श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणरघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवम् साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च नमो ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्तस्वामिनि नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वते देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे A very good evening to everyone. It is a pleasure for me to be back again at the IIT Alumni Association in Sydney. I was here 2 years ago and we had a discussion on stress management, if I remember right. And my association with the IITs goes back to the late 1980s. I used to visit to give lectures to the students, and since then the connection has remained, and I feel very happy to be associated with current as well as ex-students of the IITs. Today the topic is Dharma in business. Thankfully it isn't business in Dharma, because nowadays dharma or dharmic institutions, or they somehow have become commercialized to some degree, and therefore people think of these institutions as simply vehicles of commerce or vehicles to fulfill certain other agendas. Of course, that is not entirely true for everyone, maybe a few instances here and there. But coming back to our topic of dharma in business, the question may arise as to whether it is indeed reasonable for us to juxtapose the two terms, dharma and business, together. And the question may naturally arise, is it not some kind of contradiction? Because business has this implication of some selfish activity, because I'm doing something for myself. I'm doing business to earn a profit for myself. Because the reality is, nobody does business to make a loss, isn't it? Everybody does business of any sort. Any economic activity is always done keeping in mind a profit. Earlier there were certain charitable organizations, etc., which used to be called non-profit organizations. But then the word was changed to not-for-profit organizations, because there's a difference between the two. You know, a not-for-profit organization means that profit is not your primary motive. But if you don't make profit, then you cannot sustain, you cannot survive. You may have some other noble objectives, and you may want to earn profit to fund those activities. Or your whole idea is to see that those objectives are met. But if you don't make profit, if you don't make your ends meet, then your whole organization collapses. So even though in many organizations commerce is not the motive, they are not commercially motivated, still profit is important. So when we speak of profit as a motive, there is some kind of a selfish connotation to the word profit. It is almost like a word that is not good. When you say profit, you know, I want profit. And then on the other hand, you have dharma, which has this connotation of being completely selfless, of being pure, of being sublime. So how is it that we can bring together these two terms? One which has a selfish connotation, one which has an unselfish connotation. So this is indeed a very important very important consideration. Now, since we are using the word dharma, it's important to at least have some kind of discussion on what dharma means. As such, dharma is such a complicated and vast topic. It is the subject of many lectures, not just one lecture. It's a subject of books and whole theologies and philosophies. But that is not the scope of our discussion today. Today our discussion is specifically with respect to business. But nevertheless, we will need to invoke some understanding or some principles of the word dharma in order to see how we can apply dharma to business and see if at all it is compatible. So generally the word dharma in common usage, especially in India, implies things like religious faith. Let's say, especially in the regional languages in India, when you use the word dharma, they mean it to imply whether you're a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Sikh or something. That's one common understanding of the word dharma in India. But that is not actually a very complete understanding. It's a very, very inadequate understanding. And it's not a very universal way of looking at it. Sometimes the word dharma can be seen in terms of just performing a duty, an occupational duty, the dharma of a father, the dharma of a mother, and so on. Now, there are many other very deep theological ideas, but as I said, I will not go into it. Suffice it to say at this time that in very simple language, dharma can be understood as being the foundation for everything that exists. Dharma can be understood to be that underlying law or that order which is inherent in everything in the creation, in the universe. Dharma is the way things are meant to be. That is what dharma is. And if at all we were to give another word for this kind of dharma, this definition of dharma, I would say one word that applies very closely is harmony. Now we all understand the word harmony, and it gives a certain understanding, a certain picture of things emerges in our mind when we speak of harmony. Two people are in harmony with each other. Or there's a musical orchestra, symphony, they're in harmony, the different players and instruments are in harmony with each other. So the word harmony implies something very sublime, something very beautiful. So dharma implies harmony. And when there is harmony, then we can understand that some basic principles of dharma are being followed. It's difficult to pin down, and especially within the scope of my talk today, as to what exactly constitutes dharma. But let's talk about the symptoms of dharma. That if dharma is being followed, there will be harmony. If dharma is not being followed, there will be disharmony. A very simple understanding of the terms. So dharmic activity is that which enhances and restores harmony. Adharmic activity is that which enhances and restores disruption and disturbance. So that is how, in very simple language, in practical terms, we can talk about dharma and adharma. So it's not so much a matter of being a Hindu, Muslim, Christian, etc., etc. We are talking of some very, very universal, non-sectarian principle. Yes? So what areas are we speaking about when it comes to harmony? If our life has to be in harmony, there must be certain areas of our life which must be in harmony. So one can identify 8 such categories. The first one, and I'll speak briefly about each one, and then eventually I'll come to business and how these things have to correlate to business or any economic activity or commercial activity, even a technical activity, since you're all from an IIT background, you're technologists by training. The first one is environment. Now, we all are aware of the beauty of nature. When we go out and see the rolling hills and the lush green fields and, you know, the nice climate, the lakes, pristine, pure water, flowing rivers from the mountains, it invokes a sense of awe, a sense of inner peace, of serenity when we are in the midst of the beauty of nature, isn't it? Now we see everything is in harmony. But the moment you see that that harmony or that beauty has been disrupted because the soil has been polluted, the air has been polluted, the water has been polluted, and all sorts of unnatural things abound. For example, as we come into Sydney City or in any other major metropolis for that matter in the world, do you see harmony? The environment has been so rapidly and so comprehensively changed, there is hardly any beauty of nature left. The environment, especially in the city areas, has been practically destroyed. So any activity, therefore, that restores, that enhances harmony in nature is a dharmic activity. And anything that destroys the sanctity of the environment, the beauty of the environment, the balance, the tender, gentle balance that exists between different parameters and factors in the environment, that is adharmic activity. It can also, in Sanskrit, according to the language of the Bhagavad Gita, be called ukra karma. For example, we drill for oil. And that drilling is a very vigorous and a violent activity as far as earth is concerned. It's quite an assault on the earth. You may remember many years ago there was a massive natural disaster, a tsunami that hit Japan. And it was such a big calamity, and then there was a nuclear reactor that leaked and it caused again a big devastation. And in the northern part of Japan, there were underground trains that just vanished because they have the tube, railway tubes that go some kilometers under the ground. Not just 50 meters, 100 meters, some kilometers under the ground. And because of the tsunami, the earthquake that led to a tsunami and all that, the trains just vanished. You know, they were somewhere under the ground, buried and finished. And there was vast devastation that was formed. And when I was reading some of the articles in relation to that, it was mentioned that it is when these underground railways were made for 3 kilometers, 5 kilometers down, so much of digging, so much of upheaval, so much of vigorous, violent activity going on, shaking the earth in its very core. So it has created such an imbalance. The whole balance has been spoilt. So it's very delicate, and any slightest bit of disturbance then can create havoc. So this was one of the theories I read in one of the newspapers and magazines. So it goes to show that activities of technology, of commerce, of business and so on, because ultimately oil drives everything now. So our whole economy is based on oil. And when we do this without regard to maintaining any environmental balance, see the havoc that is created. See the disharmony that is created. So here is a kind of a business. Even in Bhagavad Gita, this is referred to as ukra karma, this kind of activity. So that is as far as the environmental balance is concerned. The second, I would say, is the economic harmony and balance. Because we have encouraged and engendered and fostered a very strongly consumerist economy, we see that our modern day propaganda and our whole economy and commerce is geared towards simply increasing unlimitedly the wants of the population in such an unsustainable way that it just collapses. And therefore we see the economy is always going these cycles. There are depressions and there are recessions and there are booms. And then there is inflation, there is unemployment, and it creates so many problems. Nobody can say that the economy is balanced, not for any length of time. Because the very way of the economics that we follow, the business that we follow, our whole model of development that we follow is not as per the principles of dharma. Because it is not conducive to the harmony of the economy even. In the olden days, the economy was much simpler. And even though disturbances were created, but they were mostly because of either natural calamities or because of wars. So these were the two primary reasons. But here, we have something that is quite unexplained. Something crashes somewhere in some stock market in some place and the whole economy goes into a tailspin. So it's very delicate. Everything is so delicately interlinked now that even a small disturbance in one corner of the globe sends very strong waves of disturbance into another corner of the globe. Whereas with the economy, the foundational principles of economy are simpler and more natural and less disruptive, then what happens is that disturbances at one place remain isolated and they are not transmitted to another place. So even if there is a calamity, it's in one place, it's localized. So the economies at other places go on and they can support the one that is in trouble. So economies that will be dharmic, businesses that will be dharmic, will yield a very stable economy, relatively speaking. In this world, nothing can be really completely stable and sustainable. So that's environmental and economic. Then we come to physical, our bodies. Now we know that the pace of development and the kind of pollution we have and the stress we lead and so on, it creates such a terrible effect on our health. I was in Melbourne recently and I was at a health food shop that is owned by somebody I know, and he had a nice slogan on his shop. He says, buy organic food. Or in other words, what your grandparents called food. You know, so I thought it was quite a nice humorous line. Which means that what we eat is not really food. It is mixed with so many chemicals and this. It is so artificial. How can we have good health? And then we have to inhale the toxic fumes of automobiles and the industry and so on. And then we have to, when we fall sick, we take all the chemicals into our system, the antibiotics and everything else. They are very effective sometimes, no doubt. But ultimately we are pumping ourselves with chemicals and leading such artificial and destructive lifestyles that our health collapses. We have experienced that in two generations previous to ours. We know people live much longer. Although people say the mortality rate was higher because there was no medical cures for certain types of diseases. But those who lived, they lived hale and hearty. I was just recently, now a few hours ago, talking to a gentleman who I know, who is my host actually here. And he was saying that his father, even at 86 years of age, he was eating, he lived in Punjab, and he was eating, you know, walnuts and carrots and all his teeth in order. Everything was fine. He was active, going to the fields, coming back, hale and hearty, no cholesterol and no diabetes and sugar and this and that, every day drinking lassi and milk and cheese and paneer and everything going on. There was no problem. They were living healthy lives. But today we have umpteen allergies. We have to be sensitive about what we eat, what we don't eat, which place we go. So physically speaking, there's something wrong. Our whole civilization has created disharmony in the health situation. Psychological, the next point. Dare we say that are we happier in this age? No. Despite all the advancement of science and technology and commerce and for all the sophistication and polish of our modern day life, the fact remains that we cannot honestly and truthfully say that we are a happier generation than the previous generations. The previous generations didn't have so much money as we do. They didn't have so much economic and technical development as we do. Their cities were not as sophisticated as our cities are. They couldn't have robots and space satellites and so on. But they were happier. Their lives were less stressful. Today, the most prominent and highest paying occupations are those that are dependent on the suffering of others. Psychiatrists, doctors, lawyers. Yes? So psychologically speaking, people today are not at all happy. You know, people go for stress, they go because they're all stressed out. One of the most common things that people ask when I go for lectures or we meet people is saying, you know, I'm too stressed, can you tell me something to help me? Because he has to go for work, there are deadlines at work, the whole economic system is such that it puts tremendous pressure. And not just in the workplace, even children are under so much pressure. In Japan, this is the 13th or 14th consecutive year in which there were more than 30,000 suicides every year. If you do some arithmetic, you'll see how many it comes to. Say every 15 minutes, maybe one suicide or something like that. So, or whatever the number is. And this is one of the most advanced technological countries in the world. And a majority of the suicides happen with the younger people. And even more so with the school children, because they're not able to cope with the pressures that the society puts on them. They have to excel, and then they have to get into this university and then go out and then get into this job and then work very hard. They have no social life. They sleep in their office and they work morning to night. And this kind of pressure the children can't take. So our whole civilization, and ultimately it's all for the sake of economics. It's all for the sake of doing business properly, your job. You need a job, you need money. So, psychologically, we are definitely not happy as a generation. Look at the next part. Look at the political situation. The political situation is rife with scandals. The nexus between business and politics. Yes, in any country. You look at the scandals that come out in the newspapers. And in India, where I was recently, every day there's something about some businessman who knows some politician and he worked the system around for his benefit, and then the others who are deserving cases, they don't get it. So it happens in every country, but maybe not in such a gross way. It happens in a very subtle, sophisticated way at high levels. But the nexus between business and politicians means that certain political decisions are taken which affect the whole nation, which may not be in the best interests of the nation and of the people, but they are taken because of a quid pro quo between the businessman who wants his profit or the company that wants its profit, and the politician who also needs money for himself or herself and for his particular party, political party. So in this way, our whole civilization now, our whole model is such that it creates this kind of nexus, and therefore the word has come about now, crony capitalism. Many of you may have heard it. And because of this, greed becomes a predominant driving force in the political establishment and also for business. So business and politics, they feed on each other. And they create a very unstable situation, which is unethical. And every other day in every country, there is some or the other scandal, business scandal. And some politicians are often involved in these things. So therefore, this is all because of adharmic business activities. So let's go on to the next point. The next point, let's say, is social. Now, what is happening because of our business models today? We are undoubtedly very sophisticated. We have cars, we have big homes, but socially we are becoming alienated from each other. Two generations ago, we would have people walking into each other's homes, even in the Western countries, what to speak of India, where the village lived like a family, the street lived like a family, the children would go into each other's homes, take lunch and dinner anywhere in any home, it was all right. It was one family. Relationships were so much better between people. There were qualities of cooperation, of understanding, of tolerance, of forgiveness. There was love. There was sense of brotherhood and sisterhood amongst people. Society was much better, warmer, and knit together better. Not that there were not problems. There were no problems. Of course there were. But if you see it compared to today, we see that the social degree of social cohesion earlier and the degree of warmth in relationships and the love and trust that existed between people, you cannot compare it to now. And actually, it will not be an exaggeration to say that the more sophisticated our whole economic model has become, and everything is based on this economic model, and therefore business comes in the picture. So the more sophisticated our economic model has become, the more distant people have become from each other in their relationships. And therefore, neighbors also don't know each other. It's very common for people staying in an apartment block who are neighbors right the next door to you, and you don't know who that person is. You never talk to that person. And I've seen this in a couple of occasions in some countries. And I asked, who's staying next door? He said, there's some man. I know some man, but who's staying there? He said, I don't know his name. I've just seen him once or twice coming and going. How long have you been here? 20 years. Neighbors for 20 years, but they have never spoken to each other. Even when they pass each other, probably they're busy in their own thoughts and they just go on. So this is the level of life we have in the world today. And if you try to be very close to somebody, he'll probably sue you, or you know, you're afraid what's going to happen. Is intrusion into my privacy or something like that. So we are becoming very touchy, excessively individualistic. We cannot tolerate other people in our lives. So we have dysfunctional relationships. This is happening. Whereas in the older days, people, you just walked up to people, you talked, you went into each other's homes, it was easy. Everything was so nice. So now, obviously, there's something adharmic going on because of which our social relationships are crumbling. Then let's talk about cultural the cultural part of it. Culture is so important in our life, you know. What is music, it's dance, it's drama, it's literature, it is entertainment, it is so many other things that encompass this wide term called culture. Now, because of this modern-day globalization, where the world is one economic village, what is happening? This homogenization of culture is happening. So there is diversities in culture are being destroyed. Now, most of you are from India. And when you come here, or to any other country, you know your language, you come, you speak it, you hold your culture for a while. The next generation comes along, and they do it 50%, maybe not even that much. And the next generation's gone. And this is happening in India as well. Similarly with any other country, I'm just giving the example of India because most of you are from India. So what happens is that people in all countries in the world are getting more and more distanced from their original culture. They're not speaking their languages anymore, they don't know their culture anymore, and it's just one big culture, the Coca-Cola culture. One big culture, the rock and roll culture. One big culture, the IT and the gadget culture. That's the only thing they know. The children will grow up also just doing this. Whereas the usual things of, you know, children playing, climbing trees, falling down, breaking a bone or two, those good old days are gone. And now you'll have, very complex things where children cannot play with nature. They have to have their gadgets and so on. So, therefore we see that cultural life is practically gone. And is replaced by just the lowest denominator of harsh music, which is not melodious even, and the forms of culture that are prevailing are common everywhere. So one standard of culture is being imposed through so many different media, and one of them is business. Because people from different cultures and different lands, which are traditionally, at least for the last few centuries, have not been economically so developed, they want to be like the developed world. And so they try to be like the others in the developed world. So they give up their cultures, they give up their habits, they accept everything. This is why how the modern day economic model, the social model, is just homogenizing everything and destroying our culture. So there is no harmony left in that anymore. And finally, spiritual. You see, spiritual harmony is the most important. Everything else may be what it may. At least if the individual is spiritually realized, is spiritually in harmony with himself or herself, then the other things can also be taken care of and they can be taken in one stride. But when our modern-day civilization doesn't leave us any time or any energy or inclination for spiritual developments or spiritual discussions, what possibilities there left now for any spiritual progress? Spiritual progress is actually the pinnacle of human achievement. It is a perfection of human life. And slowly people are realizing this. Therefore we see even in the so-called developed world, we have people taking to Eastern mysticism and Eastern philosophy because they're realizing there is something that is unfulfilling in the materialistic ways of life and the sophistication of the modern day world. So therefore, if dharma exists, all these eight factors that I mentioned must be in harmony. If they are not, it indicates our activity is adharmic. We are not speaking of Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Sikh here. So what are those? Environmental, economic, physical, psychological, political, cultural, social, spiritual. these eight things. So that morality, that system of values, that ideology, that set of practices that uphold harmony in these eight categories is dharma. So we can know dharma by its symptoms. If we are following dharma, then these eight, all of them will be in harmony. Or at least a majority of them will be in harmony. If that doesn't happen, then we have to introspect and see what is going wrong where. Now, our whole idea is wealth generation, how to get more and more money. And this is the driving force for most people in the world today. And therefore we think that by accumulating more and more wealth and more money, we will become happier. And that is indeed the driving force for business. And now we'll come to the point of business particularly. The function of any business is to generate wealth, isn't it? But the problem is, when the people responsible for running the business think that wealth is only money, when they think that wealth is only in property and assets, or even when they think that wealth is in terms of, let's say, power and prestige. Wealth in general, if we were to define it in a very, very simple way, wealth is anything that we consider desirable, pleasurable, or valuable. For example, health. Is not health something valuable for us? We realize it when we are sick. And therefore the proverb, health is wealth. We've all heard that proverb. So why do we say health is wealth? Because health is so valuable to us. When we have that, then we are wealthy. Let's say you're the richest person in the world, but also the sickest, with the most diseases and difficulties in the body. What is the quality of your life? Can you be happy? You would rather trade away all your money for good health. There is a Spanish proverb which I saw in America in one of the shops which says, we spend our youth destroying our health to earn money. And we spend our old age in spending our money to revive our health. It was in a, you know, roughly translated there. Devotee who understands Spanish translated it. So we sacrifice our health for money, and later we sacrifice our money for health, but it's too late anyway. So the point is that health is very valuable to us, and therefore it's wealth. Similarly, peace of mind. Isn't that something valuable to us? So isn't that wealth? Let's say loving relationships with people. Isn't that something that we want and value very much? So isn't that wealth? If you don't have good friendships with people, you don't have people you like or you love with whom you don't get along, what would be the quality of your life? So that is also wealth, having good quality of relationships. In this way, if you analyze in these eight categories, if you have all of these, you are wealthy. Let's say some people prefer to live in a countryside because they want to experience the nature, the beauty of nature and the serenity of the place, because it's a form of wealth for them. And those who stay in big cities, for them, the sight of green is a sight for sore eyes. So you have to pay so much more money to just get some green space around your house. So we need to revisit our idea of wealth. So wealth, therefore, is not just to be seen in terms of goods and services and assets and wealth and money, but is to be seen in terms of something that is tangibly very satisfying and pleasing to the heart, pleasing to all of us. Actually, one is to be considered wealthy not in proportion to the number of things one possesses, but rather one should be considered wealthy in proportion to how few one's wants are in life. This paradigm shift is required in accordance with the principles of Dharma. These are some of the implications of following Dharma. This is what it means to be following Dharma. If you are, then these must be the results. We must simplify rather than make everything more complex. We must harmonize rather than the opposite. The sign of an advanced civilization is not that it increases the wants of its constituent members. The sign of an advanced civilization is the degree to which it can minimize the wants of its members and indeed transcend them, go beyond them for a higher spiritual purpose. That is a measure of an advanced civilization. So who is a rich person? Who is a wealthy person? Now we have to think very deeply about these concepts. So therefore, because business is the business of generating wealth, we have to rethink now, what is the role of business in our life? So when we speak of dharma and business, now we'll have to sit back carefully and analyze. What does it mean to run a dharmic business? I was narrating this example at a previous talk on a similar topic in Mumbai some 6 or 8 months ago, that I was reading a newspaper article on a flight. The person in front of me was reading it. It was a business newspaper, economic newspaper. And the article was saying that you interview with some CEO or something like that. And he was saying, I don't remember exactly, but it was something like, the key to success is to satisfy your customers' needs. That was what he was saying, and how important it is to satisfy the customer and every need that he or she has. And I started thinking about that, and I realized actually that's not so. And soon enough, when I landed in Bombay, I met one gentleman. This gentleman runs a restaurant, a pure vegetarian restaurant, and naturally he doesn't serve liquor in that restaurant. Now, because he's seeing all the other restaurants around, they're making a lot of money because they have liquor and non-vegetarian food served in those places. So he was thinking that I should also maybe start liquor because I'll make more money. You know, it's getting hard. The competition is very stiff. So then he asked me, can I start it? So I said, well, you know, it's your decision, you have to see. But what do you think? I asked him, what are your principles you want to follow? Take your decisions according to that. What is your dharma? And I took him through the discussion. So is killing animals okay for you? Some people eat, it's their principle, it's okay for them, that's one thing. But for you, is this okay? He said, no, it's bad. If it's bad, then why are you doing it? No, customers are asking, they're saying, no, your hotel will prosper and flourish if you serve us liquor and non-vegetarian food. So then I remembered this article that I had overseen in somebody's newspaper with, you have to satisfy the customer's every need. He said, no, you don't have to do that. You have your principles too. The customer may have any kind of needs. Doesn't mean that you have to simply go on satisfying every single need of the customer, even when it conflicts with your principles. If it doesn't conflict with somebody else's principles, he will have his beer bar and he will have his non-vegetarian food that he serves there, and that's his lookout. But as far as you're concerned, I told him, if that is your principle in life, then you don't worry what the customers are saying about this. So therefore we see that we have to guide our business practices and business policies and our decisions based on certain principles, based on certain values. Otherwise, what good is it? Otherwise, if it's just going to be profit at any cost, then how is it dharmic? There is that little quip I remember reading. Earn profit by gracious means, but if not, earn it by any other means anyway. You know, so there are a lot of people who make these quips. But the point is that, you know, activities of this sort where we say the customer is king or queen or whatever, and then we just surrender to the customer because, you know, I have to cater to the customer. Yes, we have to serve the customer within certain parameters, within a certain framework of my dharma. And then if the customer fits into that, it's well and good. Otherwise, he can always go to another one, another restaurant or hotel, and he can do what he likes over there. So therefore, as sensitive and evolved individuals, we must think very deeply on this. There are many examples like this of how we've made a sea change in the way we conduct our business. When business is done according to the principles of dharma, it creates happiness. Dhana dharmam tatah sukham. There is a proverb, you know, in the Hitopadesha, Sanskrit proverb, that says that when you have dhana or money that is used for, you know, used in dharmic way, that is not used in objectionable ways as per the principles of dharma, that gives sukham. Vidya dadati vinayam. Knowledge, that is true knowledge, gives us humility. It gives us guidance. Vinayad yatri, vinayad yati patravat. So, you know, the humility and the sensibility gives us eligibility or qualification. Patratvat dhanam apnoti. So from such eligibility and qualification, one is able to earn wealth. And then, dhanat, then from wealth, dharmam, the when that wealth is used in a dharmic way, tatah sukham, then there is happiness. So therefore, if businesses are run according to these principles of this sort, then there will be happiness everywhere, sukham. Because things will be in harmony. This is a natural function of it. But if the root is knowledge. It all starts from knowledge. So spiritual knowledge is a key. I remember a little joke which somebody told me years ago, that there was a person living in the desert. He was very poor. He just had a camel and he was a nomad living, and he had a little bit of land in the desert. And somehow oil was struck in that desert. And overnight he became not just a millionaire, but a billionaire. And he had never lived in a city, or else he had never driven a car, he didn't know anything of this. But now that he started getting so much money, then he bought the biggest car that was available, the high power car available. So he sat in the car, he didn't know how to drive the car, he turned on the ignition key and then pressed the accelerator. He was in the marketplace. And it went right through and created havoc and broke all the shops in the marketplace. So similarly, you know, when we acquire power and science, technology, economics, etc. is power. So when we acquire this sort of power to cause change in the world, but we don't have the spiritual knowledge, the dharmic nature that goes with it, we create havoc with that knowledge. The greatest trouble in the world is created by educated people, not by uneducated people, isn't it? It's the illiterate people, though, how much harm can they cause? Right? It's the real brainy ones who are the cause of the biggest problems, actually, in the world. And some interesting bit of information. In Sydney, I know a person who is a jeweler. He has a jewelry shop, an Indian immigrant. And there have been a spate of robberies and burglaries in these jewelry shops. And the police are not able to do anything because they have so much on their plate. Even though the CCTV is there, everything, the record, the evidence, everything is there, but the police just, they arrest the person and then let him go after a while. And they say, because we can't cope, there's so many of them. And so the Jewelers Association has got together. And they're saying this is a real major problem, so we have to go to the premier, whoever, the political head of the state. And they said, we have to go, so they made a petition. And they have done the research and found that there are certain people who are living abroad, I think in the Middle East or somewhere. What they do is they contact the brightest kids in the schools, the most intelligent children who are onto all of that as social media and all of that. And they indoctrinate, they tempt them with so many ways. They get in touch with them and induce them to do the robbery, and then they burgle. They get the jewelry, they give it to them, and they get some $500 or something. The jewelry is probably worth many, many thousands. So this person was telling me that the brightest of the students are picked by these people because they know they have the brains to do it properly. So there is intelligence, there is ability, there is this kind of technology available, there is things, but that dharmic knowledge and that dharmic tendency is lacking, so it creates havoc. This is the problem. Gone are the days when a situation like that given in the Mahabharata would happen. There was a farmer. He bought land from another farmer and he expanded his farm. One time he was tilling his land and his plow struck something in the ground, and lo and behold, he found that there was a big treasure chest over there. Now, if someone had found it today, let's say one person buys land from somebody else, once he has bought the land and he discovers the treasure in the land, what would he do? He would pocket it. But this person said no, he took the treasure, he went back to the seller of the land and said that, you know, I found this treasure, please take it. So the person said, no, it doesn't belong to me. I've sold the land to you. So this one says, I only bought the land from you. I didn't buy the treasure from you. So you take it. So in this way, both of them were fighting. They were quarreling about who should keep the treasure. A complete antithesis of what it would be today, isn't it? An opposite situation. And then finally, they went to the king to resolve the issue. And the king was thinking, my word, what do I do with this? Now, this, I've adjudicated all sorts of, you know, quarrels, but this one is quite unique. So he finally, he had a brainwave. He asked one farmer, do you have a son? Yes. He asked the other farmer, do you have a daughter? He said, yes. Why didn't you get them married and give the treasure to them? So both the farmers were happy, and it came to a happy conclusion, the whole problem. But anyway, the point is that, you know, today we have come a far, far, such a long distance from all these beautiful incidents. All we need to do is to just bring back the focus on the fundamentals. There is all the more need for us to have more discussions on what constitutes dharma exactly. What are the varieties of dharma? What is the highest dharma? And then we will see the quality of our life will improve in every respect. And because business is such an important segment, or economic activity is so crucial in human society, no human society can function without some kind of economic activity. So, if dharma comes in to the way our business activity is conducted throughout, then it will percolate down to all the other segments of our life. And harmony will come into all these eight segments of life. There's much more that can be said, but I think harmony also means that we end on time. Don't go over time. So I will stop here. What is the time now, please?
We still have 5 minutes.
Okay, but anyway, I think we'll have more questions and answers, probably.
So we have 15 minutes of question and answer time. So I would like to invite any questions that you have.
Please feel free to ask questions or make any comments. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for that talk. I appreciated hearing those 8 points, and I will remember those 8 points of disharmony, where we need to see more harmony. One thought that kept coming to my mind was that we are so embedded and enmeshed in this system of disharmony. It's quite hopeless. We might become hopeless thinking that Dharma is already long gone for us, particularly if, unless everyone agrees to do it together, how are we going to restore that dharmic harmony across all of these systems? So we might think, I'm living in an adharmic, corrupt system, and therefore in order to survive here, I too must adopt the normal mode of being within this disharmonious environment. So what advice would you have for us in order to, how would you respond to that particular doubt, and what advice would you give us for restoring Dharma across these different systems, which appear much, much bigger than any of us?
So your question is essentially that the adharmic environment is so overwhelming, and the prospects of rectifying it and bringing in dharmic life seem so remote that it's very tempting to just go along with it. In other words, what you're asking is, the tendency is, if you can't beat them, join them.
Well, when you say it like that, it's...
Right, isn't it? It's the tendency that people will have, that it's too overwhelming. We're talking of dharma, dharma, but everything is so adharmic. What can I do as one person, individual? Might as well just go with the flow and just go along and do whatever little I can in my life. And, yeah. So that's a very natural way to think about it. I want to give some news of hope. That is, that the greatest revolutions, positively even, negatively also, but even positively, the greatest changes in life, in the world, have many times happened just because of the convictions of one person. And you look at big changes that have happened in the world, good or for bad. Say one Hitler made such a huge change in the world. One Stalin, one Mao, such big changes. Or you look at the great spiritual leaders in India, or other great saints of other faiths in all over the world. One saint of whatever religious denomination, what impact he had on so many people. One man. So, we can take hope from the fact that we can make a shift, we can make a difference, we can make a change. And that is actually what gives us a sense of satisfaction, that we are making a difference. And we can make a difference even to a little degree in our life. Somebody sent me this little internet story of this young man who is on a beach, and the waves are bringing to the beach many starfish. You know, starfish? And they're all coming onto the beach, and they're without water, and they're in the last stages, they're thrashing about, and they need to be put back in the water. And there's literally thousands and thousands of them that the waves are bringing in. But when the waters recede, then they don't carry back all these starfish with them, so they're left stranded on the sand. So this one young man, he was picking up one starfish, throwing him deep into the water. So that starfish now survived. Then taking the second one, and then throwing him back. But meanwhile, there were thousands here, and more coming with the waves. So there was another man who was watching this young man. And he went up to him and said that, you know, isn't it futile what you're doing? What difference is it going to make? there are thousands of these starfish that are dying, and you're just lifting one at a time and throwing. What difference is it going to make? So the young man looked at the old one, the other man. He picked up one starfish, threw it into the water, and said, for that one it made a difference. For that starfish, it was a difference between life and death. So yes, we may not be able to change the world like some of the great saints have done or some of the great personalities have done in history, but we can do a little bit. Generate positive energy in this world which is full of negativity. Generate some dharma. You know, you have these diffusers, that fragrance diffusers. You have some liquid and you put something there and the fragrance diffuses all over the room. So we can be these diffusers of dharma. We can, in our own little way, wherever we meet people, whoever we interact with, by the way we live our life, by the way we carry ourselves, by the principles and values that we cherish in our life and practice, we can set an example to inspire and educate others. And together, then when more and more such people come together, there is strength in that unity, in that group. And that can then make a further change. So if more and more people who think like that in a positive way come together, then it can make a very big change in the world overall. And that's how all these revolutions happen. One person, then a small group, then a bigger group, and a bigger group, and a bigger group. And then that becomes the established thing. So we should not lose hope. We should continue, because the principles of dharma are eternal. Whereas the events of life around us are transient, they're temporary. They will come and they will go. So it is better we take shelter of eternal dharmic principles and never give them up, even if it is very difficult. The question is not whether something is difficult or easy. The question is whether it is right to do it or not. The question is whether it is beneficial to do it or not. The question is whether it is dharmic to do it or not. So even if the whole world were to say something, but if we understand something is not dharmic, we shouldn't do it. And then there'll be others who gather around us, and a momentum will gather. Okay. Yes.
In spite of the question we asked, have you come across any organization that is propagating dharma in the light of what you mentioned about the eight principles? Is there any movement like that? And what made me think when you talk about this, about dharma in business, is there must be a great leader. Even in Bhagavad Gita it says, you know, I think you probably know that in chapter 4 they say that yada yadagi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyuktanam adharmasya tat atmanam sajamyam. That's what Lord Krishna says. Now, is there anybody, any movement like that, anything as in the light of that? It's very difficult, as he said, I agree with him to some extent, for a single person to start. Is there any organization or anything you have come across, or movement like that?
I am what I am today because of a certain movement, otherwise I would not be here. So naturally, yeah, I can speak for myself, but I do not claim that this is the only thing. And eventually, the principles of dharma being universal, at that level there could be so many who may do it. I represent a certain institution and a certain sampradaya in which we have certain theological beliefs and our understanding of what this dharma, the Sanatana dharma is, and we follow that. At the same time, we also understand that everybody may not think the same and they may have their own understanding, so we try to find common ground so that they will also, together we can all move collectively towards a less adharmic world. Hmm? Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Thank you for explaining that so beautifully, the causes of dhamma, or the disharmony that is there. But the question I wanted to see and to ask you was, when you started the discourse today, you started about harmony in nature and how it affects you. And you gave an example of a forest and a stream and how peaceful it appears to you and whoever is in that context. And as we all know, that nature, the harmony within harmony and harmony within disharmony. So we have coexistence of two things together, which brings balance to each other. So, and we talked about in the modern days, fast forward, that we are now affected by technological advances, and even within the technology field itself, there are a lot of disruptions that are happening. But if you look at it from a nature's point of view, it is all natural. This is meant to happen. This is how it will happen. And the harmony, some of the examples that you gave us from the good old days from our grandfathers or great-grandfathers in an agrarian sort of societies where people had more interaction and more societal cohesion and all that. That was harmony in that context. But the harmony today, you take away a smartphone from your children and there will be disharmony in the house. You switch off the router, don't give the password, there's going to be disharmony in the house, in the family, right? So, the question is, we need to see the notion of harmony within the context of disharmony and in a particular time and space context. And the question, I think the first question that was asked by this gentleman here was, how do we try to change the world? My thoughts are that, why do you have to change the world? It's nature which is evolving, taking its course. And how the volcanoes create a lot of violence in a natural context. But then after that, there is a peace. And the new things get created. So the creation and destruction that will continue, if you look at it, the process that we see around us. So what is happening in our human society level? It's again the same thing. We are destroying certain things, but then we will build other things. The second question that came up was, are there any examples of some organizations which follow these dharmic principles to an extent? No one is 100%. So as you would see that now, there is a trend toward investing money in the ethical businesses. Businesses are required to be accountable to their stakeholders, not just the profits and dividends, but also their corporate social responsibility. So some of the companies are now scored and assessed on that basis. So I think my point is that we can take a notion of harmony in itself, which is great. You do need to have a balance, and balance will appear naturally, right? And I think one of the shloka from the Gita was just now, right, which talked about the moment you go away from the source, in this case, maybe God, you go away from that, and you create disharmony. The moment you come toward God, right, or in the spiritual context, you are in harmony. And I think what I liked in your presentation was that you also left a key among these eight, and you said that there is a key when we talk about the spiritual harmony first, everything else will take care of itself. I thought to me the takeaway was that was really good, and I think there is a lot of discussion required, and if we as an individual need to make little difference, I think first of all our action need to be following those principles that you have articulated so beautifully. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your very thoughtful and incisive comments. Permit me to briefly respond to some of them. Yes, one point that you mentioned was that the standards and patterns of harmony vary from generation to generation. And certainly it is true, what was possible 100 years ago in an agrarian situation is not possible now, so you come to another level of harmony. That is indeed a fact. For example, if you do not give that password, yes, there will be disharmony. But the point is, why have we allowed it to come to this stage where not giving a password would create? That's the fundamental thing that we need to ask ourselves. You see, what we are doing is, as a civilization, making life more and more difficult in the name of making it easy, working harder and harder to make life easier and easier. We are raising the bar, making things more complex. And then at each stage, we are struggling to find harmony. That is generating tremendous challenges. But because we are going away from the dharmic standard more and more, finding that harmony is very difficult. It's a slippery slope, you know. So a little something, then there's no end to it, then there's more. So it is an artificial situation. That's the first point. The second point is that in terms of cycles of nature, how it happens, absolutely right. Nature moves in cycles. Everything is cyclical, day and night, the seasons, you know, creation, maintenance, destruction, it all happens in cycles. However, what we are doing is, by misuse of our free will and by our non-adherence to dharmic principles, we are hastening the chaos. We are aggravating the chaos. So we cannot justify our adherence to non-dharmic principles by saying that nature is cyclical. It is. But when nature follows its own course, we will do that. But when the cause of the trouble is us, then we cannot attribute it to nature. We have to bear the responsibility for the problems that we have created. For example, you know, some years ago, I think in 2012, there was a huge catastrophe in the Himalayas, Kedarnath and Badrinath and all those places. And it raised many questions amongst people as to why this has happened. And one interesting debate that came out of that is it God-made or man-made? This argument was brought up. Now, at one level, you can see everything is as nature's arrangement, as something that is orchestrated by God at one level. But that does not absolve us of the responsibility of self-examination. Have we, as humans, contributed to that problem? Yes. Because, number one, we started cutting down all the trees there. So the soil was eroded, and then the water would normally get, you know, held there, but now it just flows down. Then we started making all sorts of illegal constructions in very risky territories, and we did all sorts of big dams and other huge constructions, and we upset completely the very delicate ecological balance there. We commercialized the religious tourism to such a degree that it created an enormous disturbance there in the balance. So over the last so many decades, maybe five decades, six, seven, eight decades, what we as human beings have done is to completely upset that balance. Now, can we say, can we blame nature for that? Can we blame God for that? Ultimately, yes, nature will have its cycle, these things go on. But are we instrumental? That is our question. So we have to bear responsibility where it is our fault. We cannot pin the blame on nature merely because nature is cyclical or because these things will happen in life. We are the culprits because we are contributing to the problem very, very significantly. So now the option before us, do we want to be a part of the problem or a part of the solution? Being a part of the problem means continuing the same adharmic ways. Being a part of the solution means to adopt dharmic ways. And if more and more of us do that, then the cycles of nature, be they as they are, they will go on. Day and night will continue, the seasons will continue, but we will be contributing something positive. And as far as the cycles in nature are concerned, again, let's see how these cycles are also affected because of human intervention. Let's say the global warming and the climate change, etc. Again, that's happening because of human beings. Because we are polluting, we are mistreating nature. So this cyclical aspect of nature is being completely turned topsy-turvy. The seasons are changing, the temperatures are changing, water levels in the ocean are rising, the islands are going to get submerged. So we are responsible. So that is the point. So the dharma means that we accept our responsibility, live a dharmic life, and nature will follow its course. The disturbances in nature are directly a consequence of adharmic activities of humans. The catastrophic floods or the earthquakes and the tsunamis, for example, or the pestilence and the epidemics of diseases and new bacteria which we never knew before, and new diseases, you know, for which we have no cures. We keep finding cures, but nature has many aces up her sleeve. She comes up with some newer bacteria. Because nature is merely responding to our misdemeanors. You know, just like a mother will punish a child who is being too mischievous and restrict his freedom. So similarly, we as a race are being too destructive. So Mother Nature is just giving us a little slap and saying, yes, we are going to get punished like this. So therefore, it all boils down to dharma. And you see, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, dharma means harmony. Harmony means balance. And balance in everything. If you look at nature, the earth being at a certain distance from the sun, a little here and a little there, we would have been frozen or roasted. Look at the tilt of the earth on its axis. A little here, a little there would have made a huge difference in the seasons and the way they are, and in day and night. So everything is delicate. Our bodies are balanced. According to yoga theory, there are different pranas, different pranavayus. They're in balance and there is health. So when any of the vayus gets disturbed, then there is sickness. Ayurveda talks in terms of kapha vata and pitta. When they are in balance, there is health. Slight disturbance, ill health. So you look at it, every way balance is the key. So when we live our life in an adharmic way, the balance is upset. The balance in all these eight sectors. That is why the onus is on us as human beings. So if we do things right, nature will respond in a positive way, appropriately. And then actually nature will help. And the cycles will go on, but nevertheless the level of misery and catastrophic kind of pace of change will slow down. So I hope I addressed some of the
points. Yeah, you indeed expanded on that. So that's but do you see, just as a secondary sort of question, do you see a role of governance or the governments of countries or at different levels they need to adopt some of these principles if they need to avoid another Uttarakhand floods and that sort of impacts, consequences. So the governments can play a big role, and also our educational institutions can play a big role in creating new individuals for the our next generation who is aligned to these principles. And these days it's a lot easier because you've got more channels of communication available to you thanks to technology. So
yes.
Do you see any reason why it is not happening?
It's a very good point you have made. You said that if the governments and the political establishments adopt a dharmic way of life and dharmic principles, then they could effect change in a very wide scale. So why is that not happening? I think it's because of lack of spiritual leadership. Because they don't have the proper spiritual guidance. Everyone is thinking according to his or her own intelligence, without referring to higher sources of wisdom, and without referring to not just the ancient texts of wisdom, but also those who have realized those texts and who can offer practical guidance that is rooted in eternal principles. So that is the key factor today. And that is why governments are vacillating in their policies. They have no clear policy. Practically no country in the world has any stable policy on anything. You see? So it's a lack of spiritual guidance. I think that is the key need.
Thank you. So, just one last question. Question if you have.
Yes.
Thank you, my question is, as you mentioned, there are some protections which is in every industry. And when anything, whether it's a service or a product, which goes through a quality assurance, there's a fault finding or a defect finding part of it. So the person who is getting the product, they are happy because of the individual product. But the people who go through this thing and who are responsible to create that product, how they can strike harmony. It's a very small example of for a service or a product. But we can see, like, if you're driving on the street, somebody honks from that, and even if something happens in your head, it's like, why are you honking that? Even at home or so many different places, people find fault, and then how do you strike harmony, and how should take this particular place, somebody finds fault from you, how you can be pregnant by harmony?
Your question is, how can you find harmony when people find fault with you? Well, that is going to go on. That cannot change. It will happen because this is an age of faults. Faults will be visible everywhere. We see them everywhere and others will see them in us. When somebody points out a fault of ours, we should accept it in all humility, for our betterment and improvement. That is a dharmic reaction to do, rather than getting annoyed and reacting in a way that may not be wholesome. So it doesn't matter if it's even my enemy who points out something that's wrong with me and that I could improve on, and if it's a fact, then I should accept it. That is where principles will triumph over ego. Dharma cannot flourish when ego becomes the primary factor. But if knowledge and these divine qualities gain precedence, then it is very easy. Then if everybody becomes like that, then the tendency to find fault will also go down. So these are all the various dimensions of dharma, by following which we also develop these qualities. Okay, so I want to... Yes,
sorry,
you have a question.
Since this event is live on Facebook, so
okay.
There are a couple of questions.
Okay.
But I just take one question.
Okay.
And the question is by Charu Patanka. And the question is, Hare Krishna Maharaj, spirituality is about compassion and business is all about cutthroat competition. How can the two go together?
Okay, so the question is, spirituality is all about compassion and business is all about cutthroat competition. How can the two go together? Well, we don't have to cut each other's throats. That's the point. That is the point. There is enough in the world to satisfy everybody's need, but there isn't enough in the world to satisfy even one person's greed. So if we run our businesses according to dharmic principles, if we devise the philosophy of our life according to dharmic principles, then we will not want to simply just accumulate more and more and more and more. You know, and then businesses will be much simpler, and we will not have this kind of cutthroat competition. And slowly people are coming to understand this. Modern enlightened management thinkers today in the corporate world, starting from the 1950s and 60s, Peter Drucker and his generation coming all the way down to now, they're all talking about these qualities of compassion and being ethical, and all of that is happening. People are becoming aware of that. So it's happening. So we should continue with that trend. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You have been a very attentive audience, and thank you for the very nice questions and comments. Thank you.
I would like to invite Rajiv, he's the president of ID Association, to close the meeting.
Thank you, Maharaj, for joining in today. It was our privilege and pleasure to have you with us. Thank you, Ankit, for putting us in touch with Swamiji. It's been a very fine balance between all the technical events which we have. I mean, I really look forward to more such events, and I encourage the EC to have them. Thank you everyone for coming in and staying back. I hope you enjoyed, and there are so many points to ponder and take away with us tonight. So, yep, thanks once again.